Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 2002, Philip Connors left work as an editor at the Wall Street Journal and took a job as one of the last fire lookouts in America, spending almost half the year in a 7-foot by 7-foot tower, 10,000 feet above sea level in remote southwestern New Mexico, scanning the horizon for the first sign of smoke. This job provided him seemingly limitless time to commune with nature. Connors' book, Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, is a meditation on solitude, fire, and man's role in preserving the landscape. And on the program today, we'll revisit my conversation with Philip Connors, talk about the Gila Wilderness, the country's first designated wilderness, the value of forest fires, the people he meets in his remote part of the forest, including through hikers who travel from Mexico to Canada, making the journey in several months, 20 miles a day, and the art of solitude.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Consumers paid less for goods and services last month, largely because of a sharp decrease in the cost of energy. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports that was the largest decline in prices in more than 3 years.
The decline is largely due to falling energy prices, especially for gasoline. Excluding volatile food and energy, consumer prices increased 0.2%. Rents increased, as did the cost of medical care, cars, and airline tickets. Global economic uncertainty means less overall demand for goods and services, which in turn pushes the prices of commodities down. While cheaper gas may ease the financial burden on families, that is partially offset by a slowing job market, both of which affect Americans' ability to spend. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The government reports new unemployment benefit claims were up last week and the 4-week moving average up as well. But the overall employment trend remains one of growth, even if it is slow. And the broadest measure of trade, the current account deficit, shows a higher deficit in part due to Europe's economic problems. Specifically, U.S. investors are making less money on their European investments. A top Egyptian court has dissolved that country's Islamist-dominated parliament, and it's cleared Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister to run in this weekend's presidential runoff. From Cairo, NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson reports riot police are out to curb street reaction.
Egypt's High Constitutional Court ruled that members of parliament were not elected legally. State TV says the ruling military council is taking over legislative power, a move that is drawing a sharp reaction from the Islamists who dominate parliament and youth groups who led the revolution that ousted Mubarak. The ruling also upholds a lower court verdict that found Islamists and other political parties broke the law by fielding candidates for the third of the parliamentary seats set aside for independence. The court also threw out parliament's ban on members of former President Hosni Mubarak's regime from running for office. That means his last prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq, will be a candidate in the presidential runoff that is scheduled to begin on Saturday. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi is asking for international help for her country, also known as Burma, as it moves toward full democracy. In Geneva, on her first trip to Europe in 24 years, she says she's not asking too much.
Am I overly ambitious? Well, perhaps. Yes, I think I am ambitious. But unless we aim at achieving the best that might be possible, we will be in danger of having to make do with the least that is tolerable.
And displaying her humor, the Nobel Peace Laureate says,
I don't understand why people say that I'm full of courage. I feel terribly nervous. Thank you.
Also on her itinerary, Norway, France, Ireland, and Britain. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University, at cysimsfoundation.org.
Time now for news. I'm Carrie Bringhurst. Utah has earned the most top 10 rankings of any state in an economic report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Governor Gary Herbert told attendees at the Chamber's Jobs Summit in Washington, D.C. yesterday that the state is friendly to employers and prioritizes job growth. He also praised Utah's educated multilingual workforce, and he pushed to give states control over commerce.
It is an attitude. We're saying to the marketplace, we value the entrepreneur and the business person. We're going to make sure that we have government that gets off your backs and out of your wallets, which leads me to the second part, and that's our tax reform. We've actually cut our taxes in Utah, and we've not only cut the taxes from 7% to 5%, but we've flattened them.
The Enterprising States report released at the Jobs Summit puts Utah's number two for top future boom states, number two for business birth rate, and number two for export growth. Meanwhile, Utah's foreclosure rate is the 10th highest in the nation. Data released yesterday by Reality Track shows that one in 592 Utah housing units saw a foreclosure filing in May. That's an improvement from April, when Utah had the 7th highest foreclosure rate, with one in 419 homes seeing a foreclosure filing. A 21-year-old Orem man has died after falling from a Spanish Fort Canyon spillway tunnel. He was exploring the tunnel with a young woman who called 911 late Tuesday night. Ammon Mark Latham was alive when they found him, but died shortly after being airlifted to University Hospital in Salt Lake City. That's Utah News. I'm Carrie Bringhurst.
The following originally aired in April of 2011.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. Perched in a tower high above the trees on a remote mountaintop in the unpopulated wilderness of southwestern New Mexico, Philip Connors has spent 8 summers spotting and monitoring forest fires. It's solitary work that affords the former editor at the Wall Street Journal a cherished luxury, seemingly limitless time to commune with the natural world. In his book, Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, Connors has a meditation on solitude, fire, and man's role in preserving the landscape. And we read stories of visitors, including long-range hikers and smoke jumpers and others. It takes a certain type of individual to go into this wilderness, writes Connors. And he's our guest for the hour for Access Utah. Philip Connors, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So the book's getting good reviews. Might there be more on the horizon?
More reviews, you mean?
Yes.
Or well, more books?
More books, yes.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've already signed a contract to write a second book for the same publisher and the same editor. So if I can pull it off, we'll see another one in a couple years, probably.
Very good. I wonder if you could trace in brief your life up to finding this, which has become a very agreeable occupation for you. Born in Iowa, grew up in Minnesota, and ended up at University of Montana?
Yes, that's correct. I spent my childhood on a small farm in southwest Minnesota, a couple hundred acres of corn and soybeans, and a small hog farrowing operation. The bankers sort of ushered us out of that livelihood in 1985. So I spent my high school years in a small town nearby. Yes, went and graduated with a degree in print journalism from the University of Montana in 1998. Not the most timely time to graduate with a degree in print journalism, as you can imagine.
Yeah, certainly.
But I did briefly work at the Wall Street Journal for about close to 4 years, mostly as a copy editor on the leisure and arts page, until 2002, when I did a sort of 180-degree turn and left the canyons of Lower Manhattan for the canyons of the Gila National Forest of southwest New Mexico.
Did you, I don't know, if you did you have connection and affinity for the natural world before this experience?
Yeah, I think growing up in a rural area on a small farm gave me that from the very beginning. I spent much of my childhood fishing in rivers and lakes and wandering through woods and along the edges of sloughs. So I think from the earliest days of my life, I spent a lot of time outside and really enjoyed it. Living in Missoula, Montana, when I was going to school, of course, that's a great sort of jumping off place in all directions for whitewater rafting and fly fishing and hiking and backpacking. So I did do quite a bit of that there as well. The anomaly is my time in New York City, of course.
Yeah. This was, I guess for a young aspiring journalist, this was quite a coup getting on the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, it was quite a piece of luck in 1999 to be hired on. I was hired on at basically the lowest position in the newsroom, which used to be called copy boy. Nowadays it's called something more like a news assistant. But I was just sort of the gopher for reporters when I started. And I did that for close to a year before I moved to copy editing on the Leisure and Arts page, which was a fantastic job.
So life in New York, I guess the stereotype, a lot of club hopping and the like. What was life like in New York?
Well, for me, it didn't involve a lot of club hopping because my salary did not not allow me that. It was more cramped and smoky parties in Brooklyn tenements with other young people in my same sort of financial situation. But I had one major perk of that job, and that was I could call any jazz club in the city and just say, hey, I'm Phil Connors from the Wall Street Journal Leisure and Arts page. Would you mind if I sat in on tonight's show? And that was usually a great pass into the city's jazz clubs, which became one of my great loves.
Then you you got a letter, or you had been in correspondence with a college friend, right, who had got a job as a fire lookout.
Yeah, that's correct. My college friend MJ, we had met in Missoula. And, yeah, she sent me a letter one summer and told me that she was going to be stationed on a lookout tower in the Gila National Forest. And she knew I was, you know, pretty busy in New York City and tied to my desk there on the 10th floor of the World Financial Center building. But I should try to come out and see her if I could. And sometime that June of 2002, I took her up on her offer and put in for some vacation time and went down to visit her and see what it was she did there in the Gila.
So this is pretty remote, right? And this is, you write, Gila, the first wilderness designation.
Yeah, it's an amazing stretch of pretty wild country that's always been wild. In 1924, Aldo Leopold, who wrote a Sand County Almanac, one of the great sort of founding texts of American environmentalism, he was a young forester down in the Southwest, and he conceived this idea to preserve a bit of what was then a rapidly dwindling wilderness, everywhere being kind of roads being built and the stretches of what used to be roadless wild country kind of shrinking. So he hatched a plan to draw a line on the map around the headwaters of the Gila River and preserve about 750,000 acres in perpetuity as a roadless wilderness, the first, basically the first such plan of its kind in the history of the world. So the Gila Wilderness really has this kind of potent symbolic power as the first place that we chose to say, inside this line on the map, we will exercise the utmost restraint. No roads, no summer homes, no hotels, no industrial logging, and really no use of motorized or mechanized tools of any kind. And it remains much that way today.
So you went out for, I don't know, what was it, a long weekend, a week or so? Something obviously happened. You fell in love with this place and were attracted to this job.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because I showed up and kind of fell rapturously in love with the idea of living alone on a mountaintop in this wilderness. And my friend MJ, on the other hand, had been doing it up a couple months by then up on the mountain. And she told me that she was kind of bored. She wanted to get out on a fire and see how they fought fires and get a little closer to where the action was. And I took that little opening as a way to talk myself into her job while she pursued her dream, and promptly went back to New York and gave my notice at the newspaper and flew back to the Gila for that summer, and loved it so much that I've gone back every single summer since.
That's quite the leap. That's a big change.
It's about as radical a change as you can possibly make, I think. Living in a city of 8 million people and moving to an area of New Mexico where, Catron County, for instance, just adjacent to where I was working, is huge. I think it's bigger than the state of Connecticut or something like that, and it has 3,000 residents. So, if you can make a bigger change than that, I'd like to know what that would be.
Yeah. We're talking with Philip Connors on Access Utah. We've got him for the hour. He left work as an editor at the Wall Street Journal, talked his way into a job as one of the last fire lookouts in America. He spends nearly half the year in a 7-foot by 7-foot tower, 10,000 feet above sea level in remote New Mexico, watching for fires. And he's written a book, Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout. It's a meditation on solitude and wilderness and fire and the proper role of fire in the ecosystem and many other things. Had you heard of this job before you heard from your friend?
I had heard of it because I had read about it. There is a small and pretty distinguished tradition of American writers writing about and from fire lookout towers. And they include Jack Kerouac, Edward Abbey, the poet Gary Snyder, and the great writer Norman MacLean. So I had read about the job. My friend had done this job while we were still in college. She did one summer in, I think it was 96, and then took several years, and her travels took her around the world, and before she came back and did it again in 2002. But I remember in 96, when we were still both in college, thinking, wow, I had no idea that that job still existed. And it's true that not a lot of us still exist. There used to be thousands and thousands of lookouts stretching all across the country from east to west. And now, each year, the number of us is probably down to a few hundred lookouts that are still staffed in the West and Alaska.
You have said, I read an interview that you say there were lookouts all over the country, including in New York City.
Yes. A fact I didn't know until I was working on this book was that there is still, even though I lived in New York City, there is still a lookout tower intact in a Harlem park in Upper Manhattan. And my understanding is that in the mid-1800s, they were used actually to spot structure fires in the city, which in a wooden-built city at that time were very dangerous if they got going and started moving through structures. So there were, I think, at least three lookout towers in Manhattan, one of them near City Hall, one of them way uptown at Harlem, a fact that sort of really surprised me when I learned it.
So there's a certain romance to this, also probably some downsides that you could imagine, one of those being the solitude, but we'll talk a bit about that. You write extensively on that. Maybe could you take us to your tower? How do you get there, and what's it like up there?
Yeah, to reach my tower, you have to take a 5.5-mile walk uphill from the nearest road. A gorgeous walk, but yeah, all of it uphill. And when you reach the top, you will see a cabin, which is where I live, a tower, which is where I work, and the tower has a view of about, 500,000 acres of national forest to the north and to the west. And then to the east and south, I look out beyond the edge of the forest boundary into the valley of the Rio Grande, the kind of northern edges of the Chihuahuan Desert, and mountain ranges upon mountain ranges, one after another into the distance. It's a view on its clearest days of something, if you include the mountains on the horizon, something like 20,000 square miles. It's just an amazing view.
An area larger than Maryland, you write.
That's right, yes.
And you're there for 10 days at a time.
Yes, my tour lasts 10 days. On the 10th day, I transition with a relief lookout, and I hike back out to my truck, drive back into town, reconvene and rendezvous with my wife, drink a cold beer and take a hot shower, and kind of reacquaint myself with the pleasures of civilization for a long weekend.
This part of the romance of this is you are out in the middle of the wilderness alone, except for the occasional visitor. And this is, you describe some tremendous, the power of nature. Lightning strikes. This area gets some 30,000 on a big season. Lightning strikes a year, including one to your cabin, right?
Yes, I was in the cabin once when it was struck.
And torrential rains and storms, and you're right out in the middle of nature. That must be a very attractive life.
Yeah, it tends to be dramatic much of the time. People think of the job and they think, "Wow, all you do a lot of sitting around, doing nothing," and people tend to think that might be boring. But in fact, because I live in such a kind of wild landscape, there are always things happening around me. I've had many up close encounters with black bears, who tend not to want to deal with humans at all. They turn and run, typically. I've seen mule deer up close, elk, bobcats, wild turkeys. I've been in the midst of very fierce lightning storms, and that's one of the great thrills of the job, in part because some of that lightning has the potential to start fires, but it's also a natural phenomena of just amazing power and beauty. And then, yes, you know, days of high wind, which if you're stuck in a little tower 50 feet above the tree line can be a little queasy making. So all around at any one moment are numerous dramas unfolding if you have the patience and the ability to watch closely for them.
And you have said that if you're out there in such a situation, and I guess have eyes at all, you turn into an amateur scientist of all kinds of science of the forest.
Yeah, one of them that has really intrigued me over time is what scientists call phenology, which is the onset of phenomena. For instance, when a certain wildflower, first blooms, or when say the broad-tailed hummingbirds arrive in a particular place on their migration. And having done this now for 9 summers, going on 10, I have started to have a kind of grasp of when I should expect certain things to happen. And it takes just sitting there year after year in the same place and paying careful attention and noticing, and for me as well, writing it down, to begin to absorb that kind of deep, intimate knowledge of a particular landscape, and it's one of the great joys of the job again.
I wonder, Philip Connors, what kind of person does it take to make a good fire lookout? I guess on one side, you describe a temporary fire lookout who showed up one time with his cell phone.
Yes, he's an example of the kind of person who's probably not cut out for it, because he was under the impression that even there in this remote place, he would probably still have cell reception and be able to send text messages. And there's a sort of humorous and sort of sad little part of the book where he's wandering around the meadow on top trying to get a signal and slowly realizing that he's in a place where that's just not possible. So one thing you should not expect as a wilderness fire lookout is quick and easy contact with the outside world with all the tools that we have now for that.
One of the factors, I imagine, would be a tolerance for, enjoyment of, solitude, because you're going to get a lot of solitude.
Yeah. You'd probably better be comfortable in your own skin and fully capable of entertaining and amusing yourself for long stretches of time, because you are your major source of entertainment. So one develops strategies, of course, for doing this over 10-day stretches, maybe 10 such stretches over the course of a summer, amounting to about 100 days alone. I write in the book about my love of frisbee golf, for instance, as a great diversion out in the woods. I do a lot of reading. I do a fair amount of writing. Cooking tends to be a diversion. But there are also those long afternoons of sitting in my tower watching this incredibly beautiful landscape kind of move through different moods all day, and shadow and light always changing. And that, too, becomes a diversion, just the view that's on offer outside my tower windows.
Let's go to a caller, John from Boise, Idaho. John, go ahead with your question or comment.
I was going to say I'm a long-distance truck driver, and I followed from Lewiston, Idaho, down to Boise, the Snake River along 95, and that's considered a wilderness area. And the strange phenomenon to me is, besides the fact that they have these 5,000-year-old hunting places where they got the rocks for their spears and so on, is the fact that the people come to the river and just seem to stare into that river. I don't know if I'm getting through or not. But
yes, you're coming through a little bit. I don't know, Mr. Connors, can you hear that?
The fascination with the power of that river, it seems like, and they'll stand there mesmerized, for days, staring into the river. I'm not sure. Perhaps Philip will have some thoughts on that, why they do that, or what they're looking, maybe they're looking for fish, or seem like it could be used for hydroelectric power, which I guess is against the precepts of the wilderness. Anyway, it is quite fascinating. And then Lake Bonneville is also 20,000 square miles of dry lake as you get farther south in Idaho.
Yeah, certainly.
That's the scope of standing up in that tower and looking out. They showed where the old beach was of Lake Bonneville, and that actually was the start of the Snake River, right? The water that was collected in that basin. Anyway, I apologize for the bad connection.
I think part of that's on our end as well, John. But thanks for the call. We'll get a response from Mr. Connors.
Thank you.
Philip Connors, people staring there for hours on end into the Snake River, you probably can relate.
I can relate to that in a different way. I'm staring at a pretty dry, arid landscape. But, one of the reasons that wilderness preservation has a constituency is precisely that as human beings with a long connection to the earth, we have some innate feeling for wild places and wild rivers and wild mountains. And, there are many arguments for wilderness preservation. Among them, keeping an area roadless is one good way to preserve intact large stretches of wildlife habitat. In the Gila, there's a thriving, incredibly diverse and varied sort of palette of wildlife all across that landscape. But another one is our human feeling for landscapes. And moving water is something that we respond to viscerally and powerfully, and high mountains are another thing that we respond to and hold sacred in many ways. There are mountains out in the Gila where you can find fragments of pottery shards that indicate ancient peoples came there and smashed their pots as an offering to the gods from the highest points. So I think that's indicative of our sense of what's sacred about this earth we live on.
We're talking with Philip Connors, author of Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout. He's one of the a shrinking group of fire lookouts. He's works in the Gila National Forest in southwest New Mexico. And we do have another caller, Phil, in Roosevelt. Thanks for calling, Phil.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Phil.
What is the Forest Service interested in preserving that lookout as a historic Forest Service structure? Or is it doomed to extinction? What we used to call winter lightning.
That particular lookout, among many others on the Gila, has a designation on the Register of Historic Places, and I believe that was achieved in the 1980s. So the original lookout cabin will be preserved in perpetuity. I'm not sure the tower itself has that same designation. It was built by CCC crews during the New Deal back in the late 30s, and you know, it's still standing strong about 75 years later, so that speaks well of their work. But the cabin itself is on the National Register, yes.
I hope it can be. There's only one fire lookout in Utah left, and that's the Ute Lookout, south of Manila, Utah. And due to heroic efforts of Lee Scabland in the 1980s, that lookout was preserved and new legs put on the bottom of it. But it's facing bad times again, and I hope I hope it can be preserved because of that historic significance.
Phil, do you have an idea how many lookouts there were historically in Utah? We're down to one, you say?
There weren't very many. Mm-hmm. There weren't very many, Tom.
Okay.
But it's the only one left.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bill. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
And we do have another caller waiting, but I just want to follow up with some of the history here. Maybe the majority of the remaining fire lookouts would be Alaska and in some of these more remote areas in the lower 48?
Yeah, that's correct. You find, I think, the majority of them on national forest lands, but there are also lookouts on Bureau of Land Management land, and there are lookouts in a few of the national parks in the west, but those who remain, yeah, tend to be in the Rockies and the Pacific West, and up in Alaska.
We're talking with Philip Connors. He is a fire lookout, has done that for 9 years now?
Yes. When I go back this year, it'll be my 10th.
Your 10th. So after the book tour, back on the mountain. Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout is the book. He writes movingly about his experiences in the wilderness, solitary lifestyle up there, but one that he loves. And a little later in the hour, we'll get into some of his infrequent encounters with a hardy type of people that makes their way through these wilderness areas, including, I guess, a subculture I hadn't known about before I read the book, long-distance, or what they call themselves, thru-hikers. Let's go to our next caller, Margaret in Vernal. Margaret, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Two things. Actually, historically, there are some lookouts in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the central part of California. I used to hike there a lot when I lived there. I'm now in Utah. But the other thing was, how do you communicate should you see a fire?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have VHF radios that we use to call the dispatch office back in town. So we we operate mostly through those VHF radios.
Ah, I wondered what, because telephones didn't seem to be very practical.
No, although it's funny you should mention that, because the original way that lookouts communicated with the outside world
was by telephone, wasn't it?
As you hike to my lookout, you can see still hanging from a few very old white fir trees these little white ceramic insulators, which once held number 9 telephone line that ran for miles from my post to the nearest ranger station. And, of course, they were a nightmare to to do the upkeep on, because a high wind or a lightning strike and your line was down and you had to follow it looking for the one place where the problem was.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Margaret. Appreciate your call. Philip Connors, one of the last fire lookouts from April into August, is it? You are up on a tower 10,000 feet above sea level. The book is Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout. And we'll get to an email from Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona, and your call as well, following a brief break, and talk about some of the beauties of nature, some of the encounters that Philip Connors has had, and talk a little bit more about wilderness and about fire, the role of fire in the forest. Philip Connors writes about that and some of the fires that he has seen, obviously, up close, or at least in the middle of the wilderness. So we will we'll have a break coming up. Before we get there, well, let's go to the to Steve's email before we take a break. This is Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona. Like your guest, I lived and worked in the canyons of Manhattan before making a major change in life and moving west. I am older, however, and lived in New York City much longer than 4 years. For decades, in fact. So I miss it and make it a point to get back to the city frequently. Does your guest share this feeling? Does he miss New York? And does he make it a point to spend time in the city when he can? Or is he just as happy to watch New York City fade in the rearview mirror? That's what Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona asks.
Yeah, that's a great question. Over the years since I left, I've been back on average about every other year, sometimes for business and sometimes for pleasure. My wife and I honeymooned there, in homage to our having met there. But yeah, I'm not one of those people who rejects and renounces all things urban just because I have this glorious job in the wilderness. I tend to think the best life is a life of balance and appreciation for differing experiences. And so I find myself enjoying New York when I go back, and sometimes a little bit nostalgic for it. It has its own energy and power as a place of 8 million people doing their thing and being creative and getting by day to day. So I'm glad I don't live there anymore. But I do appreciate that it's still there, and I can get back to it every once in a while and kind of savor the fruits of it again.
I know people will be wondering about your wife. Your wife must be very understanding.
I think it's fair to say she is among the most understanding and indulgent people on the planet, yes.
Now, I guess, what do you do the other half of the year?
For years, I spent that other half as a bartender in Silver City, New Mexico, where my wife and I live, which, as I say in the book, allowed me to do a year's worth of socializing in about 6 months. And then I practically needed that time away to collect my wits and center myself again. My wife went to nursing school down in Silver City at Western New Mexico University, and she's now a nurse in our local hospital. So her breadwinning abilities have allowed me to retire from the adult beverage industry, and now I spend my winters working on books and my writing.
Oh, good, good. Well, we'll take a break now, and we'll be back with Philip Connors, author of Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, after this break.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Please don't say mañana if you don't mean it.
A year ago, it all seemed utterly impossible. I was chatting with a friend in the tourism bureau here, and he was explaining how Los Cabos was going to host a G20 economic summit. A site for a 7,000-seat convention center had been picked, but they hadn't turned the first shovel of dirt yet. There were plans for fixing and improving the roads. There were plans for sprucing up the town. There were a lot of plans, and they all seemed overambitious, to be honest. I couldn't see how they could get it all done in a year. But they have, and now we're waiting for the first plane loads of dignitaries to arrive for next week's meetings. The G20 is a complex meeting of the world's top economic minds. What normally comes out of it is a stack of esoteric policies that, quite frankly, are beyond my meager comprehension. The focus this year, of course, will be on the mounting problems in the Eurozone as nation after nation seeks remediation for their plunging economies. In fact, Sunday's election in Greece could make or break the euro, which in either case will have an impact on the U.S. dollar, Mexican peso, the yen, and monetary systems across the globe. It would take a lot more than this little 3-minute spot to explain why and how, so let's just leave it at this. We welcome the visitors, all 10,000 of them, and appreciate the boost they will bring to our local economy, but we can't wait for them to go home. You see, because of the high-profile heads of state who will be arriving within the next few days, from Barack Obama to Vladimir Putin, security has been ratcheted up so high that getting around town is a lot more complicated these days. Our condo is surrounded by checkpoints set up by the federales. These aren't the normal checkpoints either. These are manned by at least a dozen officers with automatic weapons who are backed up by trucks with machine guns mounted on them. The Federale command post, with a locked, loaded, and manned armored personnel vehicle parked out front, is only a mile away. The Mexican Army and Naval Infantry are patrolling our streets, and we have a couple of Navy ships parked about a quarter of a mile off the shoreline, with helicopters flying over the coast. But the worst part? They've closed our beaches. You can't snorkel, scuba dive, paddleboard, surf fish, or even bask in the sun. We went to the beach Monday just to feel the sand between our toes once more before they closed it to the public. The place was already deserted. So, I wish the world's dignitaries well as they gather in that new convention center just up the hill. Heaven knows the world's economy could use a jolt of wisdom right now. But just for future reference, I hear Chicago is pretty nice in June. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. Thanks for staying with us through the break. And we're talking with one of the last fire watchers in America. Numbers are dwindling, but they're still out there. Summers in remote areas, perched atop towers, watching for that first sign of smoke to call in on the fire. Philip Connors has spent 9 seasons in the Gila National Forest, an area about the size of Maryland, and a vast wilderness area, a job that he loves, and his book is Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout. We have another 10 minutes left with Philip Connors, and if you would like to join this conversation, now's the time to call. 800-826-1495 is the number, toll free. Anywhere, 800-826-1495, or you can go to our website, upr.org, and email us. And the number again, 800-826-1495. Philip Connors, I wonder if you have the book handy there?
I do.
If you could maybe read us a brief passage?
Yeah, let me find something appropriate here. Okay. This is one little passage just about what it is I value about that time there on the mountain. In the world below, I tend toward the attitude of the bemused spectator. I use landline telephones, I answer email, and I've yet to renounce my wintertime access to a high-speed internet connection. But I can't in good conscience apologize for the fact that for a few months a year, I choose not to choose anything but what I read, what I eat, and when I sleep. My interests aren't tracked, aggregated, and commodified, sold back to me in a digital feedback loop requiring no more effort than the click of my finger. Up here, I'm not a six-foot-tall billboard or a member of a coveted demographic. I'm a human being, and as such, I find it restorative to be in the presence of certain mysteries our species once knew in its bones, mysteries ineffable and unmediated.
That's it's a special experience, one that many of us don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I admit fully that I am a member of modern culture as much as anyone for part of the year. I'm part of our hyper-connected world with email and high-speed internet. I don't yet tweet, and I'm not on Facebook, but I'm always lagging behind a few years in these things, so talk to me in about 2016 and I'll probably have caught up. But I do like the opportunity that I have to unplug and recenter myself in my own kind of memories and creative energies, and I find it at least restorative to live in the old way that most of us lived for centuries and millennia before the sort of onslaught of all of our modern tools and gadgets, all of which I admit are useful in their way. But I do find something special in that space where I go to when I'm unplugged from all that.
You've written that once you struggle through the swamp of monotony where time bogs down in excruciating ticks from your wristwatch, it becomes possible to break through to a state of equilibrium, to reach a kind of waiting and watching that verges on what I can only call the holy. That's the solitude that I guess would drive some people crazy. You welcome.
Yeah, I think many of us bump up against it at least sometime in our life and maybe find it a little bit frightening to be so reliant on our own wits and our own instincts and our own means of entertaining ourselves and just the prospect of an absence of human connection. But I find that if you hang with it and have the patience for it and break through that kind of frightening moment where you feel incredibly alone, on the other side are rewards for that. And as you just mentioned and read in that little passage from the book, to me it is a kind of a holy experience. I don't want to portray myself as some mystical mountaintop prophet, but the experience of sitting there and feeling yourself kind of become one with this incredible landscape out the windows is almost indescribably wonderful.
And there are people who come through. It's not incredibly frequent, obviously. You say that it takes a special kind of person to be up in this wilderness area.
It is true. I love the human encounters because it is a different kind of person you find out there in the woods that far from the nearest paved road. There's, throughout the book, sprinkled through it are my little encounters with smoke jumpers and the mule packers who pack my supplies in at the beginning of the season. And this incredible species known as the thru-hiker, people who set as their goal to walk the spine of the continent from Mexico to Canada along the Continental Divide Trail, which amounts to more than 3,000 miles in total. And these folks, some of them take a little shortcut through my area of the Gila on their way to the Continental Divide. And each year I see half a dozen or a dozen of them, and they're unfailingly interesting people. If you set out with your goal to walk 20 miles a day for 5 or 6 months, yeah, you're going to be a different kind of person. And I love these encounters. They always come as a surprise because there's no warning. Suddenly they're just on my mountain. And they never fail to be stimulating and interesting human encounters.
And you write that at 10,000 feet, it's a little harder to breathe, for example, and so some of the sort of the social niceties, the extras, are scrubbed away, and it's maybe a little more intense encounter.
Yeah, I think when people meet each other out there, especially at that altitude, people get down to brass tacks. There's no wind up or beating around the bush. The people I encounter anyway there tend to be very direct with each other, and I appreciate that as well. It's a little bit different way of interacting than most of us do in normal day-to-day life, I think. And in part, I think it's a recognition of the fact that we're kindred spirits, that we find ourselves in this place says we have something in common immediately. So, yeah.
One of the encounters really struck me. A man named Dave, he's one of these through hikers. He's hiking from on the Continental Divide from Mexico up to Canada. They try to hike 20 miles a day. It's incredible. He told you an experience he had on a similar hike in California where he had been in a relationship. He loved the woman. She had dumped him, and he found himself again out in the wilderness. So he tells you this experience. You kind of had this connection, and then he's gone. It's kind of that kind of an encounter.
Yeah, it's. I think we're also able to share that honesty with each other sometimes in those experiences because we feel pretty confident we may never see each other again. Mm-hmm. So this is my chance to tell you my story, and you can do with it what you will. His story was really, as you say, pretty striking. He found himself hiking the Pacific Crest Trail one summer and coming down off this ridge where a huge wildfire had burned, and he found himself kind of overwhelmed by that scene of the wildfire, not only its destructive power, but there was some green coming back already, and I think he felt some recognition of that having happened to him with this traumatic breakup, which was a destructive thing to his well-being, but also finding new life springing up afterwards. And he was finding that by walking out in the woods for 20 miles a day for 5 or 6 months. So, yeah, great encounters out there.
We just have about a minute and a half left, and I want to give you a chance to talk about prescribed natural fires. This is a relatively new policy, which you're definitely an advocate of. Your minute advocacy for this policy.
Yeah, back until about the 1970s, the Forest Service put out every single fire as quickly as possible. And what we realized over time, looking at these ecosystems, is that fire is a creative as well as a destructive force. And some ecosystems desperately need fire to remain a functioning, healthy forest. So especially on the Gila where I work, fire managers have been pretty aggressive, allowing some occasional lightning-caused fires to burn their way through the fire season. And what those experiments have shown is that we have a very resilient, very diverse forest that is now in a kind of mosaic state of regrowth, and we have what amounts to a much healthier forest for that reason.
We're at the end of our time. Philip Connors is one of the last fire lookouts in America. He works, his office, if you will, is on a tower 10,000 feet up in the forest, a vast wilderness area in southwestern New Mexico. And after the book tour, he'll be back on the job. Philip Connors' book is Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout. And Philip Connors, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you very much for having me.
And tell us again, your next book will be coming out, what next year, year after?
Yeah, probably a couple years from now. Uh-huh. It'll be another nonfiction book centered around growing up on a farm in southern Minnesota and my brother's untimely death.
We'll look for that. And in the meantime, the book is Fire Season, Field Notes from Wilderness Lookout. The author is Philip Connors. Thanks again so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
It is the first major week-long stage race following the Tour de France and London Olympics, the Tour of Utah. Steve Miller is Tour of Utah president, and he says six of the world's top 15 international cycling teams have committed to a race that will see some changes this year.
One of the objectives that we have as organizers of an event like this is to keep it fresh and engaging and interesting for both the sponsors and the spectators, and certainly the teams. We don't just want to race on the same courses year after year. And, you know, the cities in the state, they want an opportunity to host this as well. So it's really unique in that regard. We get to move it around. And so we've done that a little bit this year. We've shaken things up, and the overall race start will be in Ogden, Utah, which we've never done before. So stage one will start and finish in Ogden. And then stage two is different in that instead of an individual time trial, it will be a team time trial. So all the riders on a given team will be racing against the clock instead of the individuals racing themselves. Stage four is an entirely new course altogether. It's relatively flat, and it will start down in Utah County and in northern Utah County, and it will use the Pony Express route and then come back and then come up along Kennecott Copper Mine out on the west side of Salt Lake Valley and then finish in the downtown area. A couple of old standbys and some very new stages for the tour this year.
And it sounds like wherever they're riding, they're going to see some beautiful scenery.
That's so true, and that's one of the things that makes this race very unique. They've been doing the same races all their lives over in Europe, and now that racing in the United States is taking hold like it is, and these racers are wanting to race some new terrain, and especially when they can couple that with a visit to the United States, that's a big thing for them.
Well, how interested are you in having this race help increase the number of people who recreate here in the state and become aware of what we do have to offer? Is that one of the objectives?
It is, absolutely. And we strategize very carefully in terms of what assets the state has to offer and what types of places we want to showcase and what, you know, some of the scenic shots that we want to make sure to get on TV, because the race is going to be televised live nationally on Fox Sports Network. So we'll have 2 hours per day of live coverage. You can show a lot of beautiful scenery.
I guess that also helps to encourage some of the more popular racers. I understand that the two-time defending champion Levi Lipheimer will be racing here in Utah. At least that's what's expected. Is that true?
It is. We're very pleased to make that announcement. The team that he races for now, Omega Pharma Quickstep, is out of Belgium. They're headquartered out of Belgium, and Levi himself has committed to the event to come back and try and defend his title, if you will. And he's looking forward to being back in Utah, and so we're very excited about that. It's big news.
As a spectator, what can I expect?
It doesn't matter which stage you choose. Every single one of these stages is designed to bring maximum excitement. Just go stand along the course and cheer these guys on. That's one of the things that makes the race unique, is that it's free to the public. And to see these athletes in action is really remarkable. The sight of the peloton, the sound of these carbon wheels on the road, the speed with which these guys travel, it's not unusual for these guys to come by it. 30, 35 miles an hour on a flat road and, you know, upwards of 55, 60 miles an hour on a downhill course. It's amazing. Just it takes a lot of volunteers to put a race of this size on, and so we're actively soliciting participation from the public in terms of volunteerism. And you can just go to tourofutah.com and click on the volunteer tab, and then it's all electronic, and so it's very user-friendly.
Steve Miller, president of the Tour of Utah, a professional cycling race that will take place August 7th through the 12th. I'm Carrie Bringhurst.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.